Welcome to this Faith and Reason podcast. I'm Debbie Dykes. February, as most of you know, is Black History Month, and we have as our special guest Dr. Carrie Day. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Day. She is an assistant professor of theological and social ethics and director of Black Church Studies program at Bright Divinity School at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth. Carrie has a master's degree in religion and ethics from Yale University and received her PhD in religion from Vanderbilt University. Her research focuses on the ways in which faith communities can respond to socioeconomic issues such as poverty and social justice. Carrie is a published author of several books, including Unfinished Business, Black Women, The Black Church, and The Struggle to Survive in America. One more thing I think is important to mention about Carrie is that in 2012, Carrie was part of a delegation of scholars who participated in the White House Religious Scholars Briefing in Washington, D.C. She was there to discuss issues related to economic policy, religious freedom, faith-based initiatives, human rights efforts, and peace-building efforts around the world. Carrie joins me for a spirited, enthusiastic conversation about Black women's historical and current efforts for equality and human rights. With what is perceived as an uncertain future for so many of us, particularly women in this country, do you think that it's true that we have greater strength in numbers? Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I think a really important question at this critical moment. But what I want to acknowledge is that this has actually been a primary question historically about what it means to privilege coalition building in relationship to social policies and social transformation within wider society.
Yeah.
And here's just one example historically, during the civil rights movement, oftentimes, you know, the history that is repressed is that you had a number of women that were a part of the civil rights movement, such as Ella Baker, who leaves the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, known as SCLC, and goes and establishes the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, right?
Wow, SNCC, yeah.
As a way to talk about not only involving youth in how we think about coalition building and protest, yeah. But as well to bring up the question of gender at that time as it related to race. How do we think about the life chances and issues of flourishing for Black women in relationship at that time to civil rights legislation? For example, you know, welfare was a big talking point, right?
Oh, yeah.
As well as
yeah.
wages. And so fast forward to this critical moment, there's a lot of conversation about the profound need for coalition building. And here's an example. We all know that when Trump was inaugurated, we witnessed one of the largest, if not the largest, protests led and facilitated by women.
Yes, yes.
Exactly. Millions of women who were marching and walking, not just for that matter, we're talking about, you know, LGBTQ folks and men, but it was one of the largest demonstrations that we've seen within our history.
Yeah, and it was also international. I mean, women from all over the world.
That's right, that's right. Now, what's interesting is this was lauded as a critically important moment. And I think it's important to note it as such. But what I do want to do is I want to lift up this question that a number of Black feminists and a number of Black Lives Matters movement people lifted up during that particular protest and after that particular protest. And one of the questions that lingered as a way to think about the growing edges of how we participate in coalition building and movement is they asked, well, where were all of these people, particularly white women,
yeah.
during the Black Lives Matters demonstration, during other sorts of demonstrations that focus on people of color, people of color being disproportionately impacted by, you know, really crass discriminatory practices and policies, such as immigrants. This was a really big conversation.
Wow.
That sort of surrounded this particular historic moment, right? And I think that there's something right about that particular critique, but I also think, Debo, that it issues forth an invitation, right?
Yes.
How it's just not about the critique, but it's the constructive moment. How does it issue forth an invitation for us to begin thinking, as a Black feminist talk about, to begin thinking in terms of intersectionality? How, you know, what it means for brown and Black bodies to show up for women, which includes white women, but what does it mean for white women to show up for people of color?
Amen. Absolutely. You just struck a nerve here, because the Black Lives Matter movement is a huge, huge movement that is of tremendous importance. And raising awareness with women of all ethnic backgrounds to form a coalition together, and you're exactly right. So part of this too is raising awareness with white women to merge with these, to coalesce with these groups, and the Black Lives Matter is a perfect example of that.
Absolutely. I think it's, you know, sort of important to know that the founders of Black Lives Matter, they were Latina and African American lesbians, LGBTQ women that were joined by the, not just the LGBTQ movement, but community, but by other communities, transgendered communities.
Yes.
So that this is a really important point. When you talk about the history of different indigenous civil rights movements, I mean, we tend to talk about one civil rights movement as sort of the movement, which was in 1960s, led by Martin Luther King. But I think it's important to see the various and diverse civil rights movements throughout our history. And I would argue that the Black Lives Matter movement that is led by women,
yes,
led by Latina and African-American women, started by them, is reflecting on not only the problem of race in America as it relates to the judicial system, and particularly police brutality,
yes,
and incarceration, but also they're reflecting on how that affects women. Because what's interesting, take for example police brutality and incarceration, you have a lot of conversation about how it disproportionately affects Black men and even Latino men, and that's important. But the Black Lives Matter movement also lifted up the ways in which police brutality and other forms of institutional judicial discrimination affects women,
yes,
Black women out on the streets, transgendered women who are absolutely victims to police killings. So I think that you're right. There is a way in which people need to, consciousness needs to be raised, people need to be made aware, but then I also think that we have to begin within our own respective communities, we have to begin to deal with our ideas of who we think people are. So within the Black community, when it comes to gay people or transgender people, there's a particular way in which the heterosexual African-American community envisions these people as deviant, as immoral. You could say in the white community, there's a certain way in which Black men are envisioned or imagined as dangerous, as lethal. You know, I think that all of these sort of cultural ideas within respective communities about the other person really have to be deconstructed. These communities have to talk to each other.
Yes.
Because, you know, we can raise consciousness, but if people fundamentally believe, for example, that Black men are threatening and dangerous and criminal for the most part within the society, it won't matter. They won't want to collaborate or build coalitions.
So, it sounds to me like, Carrie, that, and it was probably most visible and reflective in reflecting of what just happened in terms of our 2016 election, that even though we might think that we have removed these barriers that we have constructed or that our society has constructed over the past 100, 200 years. But in reality, are those barriers actually still present? And it sounds to me like, why is it that, for example, we'll go back to the Black Lives Matter issue. When the Black Lives Matter marches and those movements begin, then why are we not arm in arm with all of our diversities walking and that be so visible and so present? And it seems to me like there are barriers that are still consciously or subconsciously in place that need to be deconstructed. And that's kind of what I hear you saying.
Right.
Let's stay on this track. Because another concern is, and another question is, what do you think? Do you think that human rights, particularly, of course, the human rights of women, of course, who are humans, who make up more than 50% of the population on the planet, well, are the human rights of the Black community, the Latino community, the LGBT community, women of all ethnic backgrounds, white women, regardless, it doesn't matter, are we and is this looking at the possibility of regression?
Absolutely, part of the fear and the anxiety and the angst within ethnic minoritized as well as women in those particular communities is precisely that we are experiencing at the structural level and in policy certain kinds of regressions. But I think it's really important to note that part of the conversation that has been ongoing prior to the rise of Trump, and I probably should also note that we talk about Trump, but I think it's really important to talk about the conditions that have led to the rise of Trump, which has had to do with white populism, in relationship to sort of this backlash from President or the election of Obama as a Black man. But not only that, some of the issues that Obama and the administration, as flawed as parts of that administration was, and I certainly was a critic on those parts, there was a lot of good that administration did. And part of that had to do with advocating for women as well as same gender loving people, the LGBTQ community.
Certainly.
That there's a kind of there's been a reaction, ideologically speaking, to that, which sort of provided the conditions out of which Trump could lead. So if it wasn't Trump, it was going to be somebody else, I would argue, because the ideological and national terrain was ready based on really, you know, the racist anger and fear that people were experiencing in relationship to all that was going on. But in terms of your question about human rights and regression, I think it's important to note that there has always been contestation on what has constituted human rights, right, in this country. And so I think this is really important to note before I talk about regression of it in this moment. So, you know, this is part of what I write about in a couple of my books, that part of the problem with this nation, although there has been incremental piecemeal legislation that have improved the lives, say, of a number of African Americans or of certain immigrant communities, there's always been a way in which the question of racial justice has not been seen as a human rights issue, right? Certainly, it's been seen as something that we sort of lost our way here in this country, and we need to come back to a place where we all get along again, because this is a land of liberty and opportunity. But the reality is the history of our nation has not been that, actually. It has been a history that has been profoundly marked by disenfranchisement among ethnic minorities from its inception, right? It's not like we're getting back to somewhere where we began since its inception. And so part of what freedom, black freedom struggles have attempted to do throughout American history. And I would argue Native American movements.
Yes.
I would argue for women's movements is articulating human rights within the framework of what it means to think critically about racial justice, but concretely, which means how do we think about racial justice in terms of employment, discrimination in employment? How do we think about racial injustice in terms of wages? Because as I write about, it is the case that in terms of income inequality, black women are disproportionately represented in terms of receiving low wages, sometimes for the same work as white women. At other times in a professional setting, they're doing the same work as white men or even black men and receiving lower wages. And so, but this is not understood as a human rights issue, right? At all. That's sure. Not understood as a human rights issue.
Not at all.
Immigrants, what it means to talk about immigrant communities and those that come over that have children, and how do we construct compassionate policies that take seriously that these people are human beings and have lives to live. That's a human right issue. But unfortunately, all the different issues that I've named are not seen as human rights issues, right? They're seen as, really, according to capitalism, well, if these people just fully integrated themselves as American citizens and pulled themselves up by their own bootstraps relative to succeeding in society, then we would not have these problems. So in other words, these people are blamed for their own social and political and economic issues rather than seeing that these groups encountered in disproportionate ways systemic injustices. And as a result, that these issues should be human rights issues. So in terms of regression, I do think that there are certain policies underneath the Trump administration that we fear, are regressing us, such as the repealing of the Affordable Health Care Act.
Absolutely.
Such as the defunding of Planned Parenthood, such as really this happened with the Supreme Court while Obama was president, but the gutting of parts of the Civil Rights Act. All of these signal regression legislatively. But I just want to make a note that regression is a relative, we have to assess it in a relative way, that there's a way in which we still rather have a long way to go in this country on these sorts of questions of racial, gender, and class justice, because my argument is that we never really have lived into what we imagine ourselves to be in terms of a land of liberty and equal opportunity for
all. Oh my God, you are hitting the nail on the head. That is absolutely correct. The poor, the marginalized, regardless of their ethnicity, this country has been built on the backs of the poor and those people that live on the margins, and we are continuing to experience these injustices. And when we talk about racial injustice, we have tended to identify that to a specific ethnic group or groups. But I'm wondering, what do you think about racial injustice in terms of white race, racial injustice? Because I'm wondering, is this Trump administration, when will people begin to see that these injustices, these systemic injustices, are impacting everyone's lives? No one is immune from the human rights that are going to be affected by an administration that is focusing on the privileged.
Right. I think that's a really important question. There's one book that I just want to recommend to those who will be listening to our session here. It's a book by a white Baptist woman scholar. She's a theologian and ethicist, and of course a minister, a Baptist minister. Her name is Jennifer Harvey, and her book is entitled Dear White Christians. Dear White Christians. And the reason why I'm citing that book in relationship to your question on how it's affecting us all is the first thing that she does is she really delves, and I mean this, she's following really historically a line of inquiry related to critical race theorists and civil rights movement leaders, that the idea of whiteness that was produced in the West, this idea of a white culture, a white race over and against, say, a black culture and a black race, is something that has been deeply fabricated within the history of the West. And when I say the West, I mean European nations during the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, Britain, France, other words, and of course the United States. So that part of the issue that's at stake is when people think of whether it's poverty or oppression, they tend to think racially, but we have to remember that the way this country was set up is that it's always the ethnic minorities that have race, right? Because we understand that race is really a fabrication. It's a socially constructed category. People can have cultures, certain kinds of ethnicities, but race is really a constructed category. That is a black race or an Asian race, that those are superficial categories over and against a white race. But then in many ways, these categories were established as a way to distinguish between white, that which is pure, and that which deserves citizenship, that which deserves a seat at the table politically and economically, over and against that which is black. For America, that meant slaves, right?
Yeah.
That meant persons that were disenfranchised in terms of the vote constitutionally. You're only 3/5 of a person. The reason why I'm just stating this very brief history that people can read more about in Harvey's book is because this way of thinking of white, you know, whiteness over and against blackness in this country has really impeded, in particular, the white community, in particular the working and poor classes of the white communities, collaborating with economically disadvantaged African Americans and other ethnic minority communities, from seeing that their lot, their life chances, their futures are bound up with black folks, with other ethnic minorities. And part of the reason why working class and poor whites have not been able to see themselves as a part of the experiences of the poor broadly in ethnic minoritized communities is because of what I'm talking about, this history of the ways in which, you know, whiteness has been seen as exceptional over and against blackness historically in this country. And so with that being said, I think it is important to note, as I just mentioned, that, you know, my work talks about that economically disadvantaged African Americans in this country have more in common in terms of life chances, economic life chances, with poor rural whites.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more.
Right, then upper class and middle class blacks. And so part of the question of how do we get, you know, these communities to see that when African Americans economically are disenfranchised, it is going to affect poor rural white communities. It is going to eventually affect, as we are seeing, the repeal of the Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act. Now you have people that voted for Trump that are beginning to speak out, who are working class and middle class whites, who are saying, oh my goodness, I did not know this would affect me in this way. I am upset.
Exactly. So I have got people around here that had no idea. First of all, we've seen the percentages of how many individuals in this country do not realize that the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare are the same thing, which is a startling percentage. But then again, I'm right there with you. These individuals, especially people like that are 24 years old. I mean, I've talked to people, young people that, oh, well, you know, I'm okay. And I've got a job. I'm okay because I'm on my daddy's insurance. And I look at these young people and I go, Whoa, wait a minute. You voted, now let me make sure I understand this. You voted for this new administration, for Trump. Were you not aware that the very first thing he did the afternoon of his inauguration was to sign a document to begin the process of repealing the Affordable Care Act, i.e. Obamacare? Do you realize that, sweetheart, you don't have any insurance if this goes through? Do you understand that? And this person said, one particular, well, you know, I'm on my daddy's insurance, so I'm 26. And I said, no, darling. If this goes through, you are not on your daddy's policy anymore. You have no insurance. You are not covered. They look at me like I don't have eyes in my head. It's just startling how uninformed. But anyway, I'm kind of getting off track, but I've got a lot of energy for this because what you said about black women and how those lives are affected, that affects all lives.
Right.
And how if women's lives are affected, then all lives are affected. There is no way. I was at an event yesterday. Wendy Davis in Houston gave an amazing presentation that focused on this reality that women who work, when women were able to move into the work arena, the Lilly Ledbetter Act, where equal wages for equal work, but that women, when they work and they earn their own money, they turn around and reinvest that money back into our economy because they're going to see to it that their families are provided for. So,
yes.
So what affects women affects us all.
That's right. And can I just also add this? What affects women affects us all. And really, this is just a further nuancing of what you said. And what affects women affects the poorest group in the nation and world, and that's poor children.
Yes.
Children. Women are the primary caretakers of children around this world. And of course, that would mean our nation. And so when we talk about disenfranchising women in terms of the wage and income, in terms of health care, in terms of child care, in terms of reproductive justice, which you and I'm sure are going to talk about, then it ends up affecting not only all of us, you know, in terms of adult communities in the present, but it affects generations to come. Those children who are economically impacted, their opportunities to flourish are impacted and even impeded because of women's disenfranchisement. So you're right.
Do you think that communities organize politically around issues that advance the concerns of a particular community? And let me go on to say this. Is it the coalition of women who create a sense of urgency and purpose that initiates social change? Is that been given a new surge of energy with with the new Trump administration coming in? And what do we do? Where are we going?
Right. I would say absolutely. I think that's been the historical record, at least in this nation. I would imagine just some of the events that I know from sort of different movements around the world that this has also been the case. But I'll just speak out of my context, our national context, and more specifically, the African-American community, about really the historical role that women have always played in serving as catalysts, right, for movement building and social change, and how women are doing it today. I mean, it's often forgotten, for example, it's Black History Month, and, you know, we celebrate Rosa Parks, you know, the woman that didn't give her seat up. She didn't get up. She was tired, and she did not get up. She believed that she deserved to stay seated and face the consequences of arrest as a form of protest. And that's how Rosa Parks tends to be framed in terms of the narrative of who she is and what she has contributed to, not only to the Black freedom struggle, but to human rights more broadly. And so the problem here with that singular narrative is that it dismisses or it ignores that prior to the 1960s movement that involved the churches and SCLC and King,
sure,
as early as the 1930s and 40s, Debo, you had women, Black women, who were leading grassroots movements Christians out of their local churches or out of their professional or social organizations, such as Black sororities, or the Black Women's Club movements that were going on. But these women were leading in grassroots organizations, and these grassroots organizations were mobilizing and galvanizing against two things: the raping of Black women in larger society, and the lynching of Black men. Now, it's important to note the raping, the forms of sexual violence and violation was something that Rosa Parks, as early as the 1930s and 40s, Debo, she was organizing along with other women, in terms of focusing on issues of racial justice. So the idea that the departure point for the civil rights movement began in the 1960s with King, to me, it's a false narrative, because it misinterprets that it's actually women as early as the 1930s that were serving as catalysts in cultivating eventually what would be the civil rights movement after the Selma boycott, the bus boycott. You then have leaders that take King down to where all of these grassroots movements led and facilitated by women, to where all these grassroots movements have been doing work for decades. And so King comes into that environment and begins to lead something that is already going on. So to your point about it's been women, I mean, we can say this about the women's movement proper. We can say this about the Native American movement for racial justice, that women have been at the forefront of that. And we can say that today about Black Lives Matter movement, Sister Song, who we'll talk about, all these different movements that are very serious about racial class justice, issues of sexual justice, that women have been at the forefront, in the vanguard.
Well, and women who have experienced these atrocities and survive them and become impassioned by them to make things different are critical in our history. And by the way, I just kind of want to throw this in. I believe there is strong evidence, now I'm not going to be 100% on this, but I do believe this, that there is strong evidence that it was the women who created the community around Jesus of Nazareth.
Yes.
Not the men. And so, you know, you look in even into our traditions, our religious traditions, the role of women all the way back to first century. And what's going to be exposed coming up fairly soon in 2017, David has been working with John Dominic Crossan on a whole new series on Paul, Apostle Paul, and it's called The Challenge of Paul. I don't want to spend a lot of time on that, but people are not being taught adequately or informed about Paul. Paul was actually taught about Jesus. Paul never knew Jesus, but Paul was taught about who Jesus was and what Jesus did by women.
Right.
Women. Yes. So the how it is, it's inconceivable to me. How in the world did women become so oppressed from the beginning? I have looked into that, into the history of that, the roots of patriarchy.
Yes.
How is it that men, not all men, but how is it that these men who are in positions of power and authority forget that if it were not for women, they wouldn't be here?
Right.
And I know that seems a little bit, Debo, where are you headed with this? But the importance, why is it that women have to be so suppressed by men?
Mm-hmm.
What are they getting out of that? What are they afraid of? I hate to use that language so as if it's not significant. But it seems to me like there is something so deep going on here. But we could spend another entire day on that topic. So let's go back. Let's go back for a moment. You mentioned Sister Song. Because, again, the event that I attended yesterday with Wendy Davis, Cecile Richards was there who spoke. It was presented by Planned Parenthood. 2,500 women. Let's talk about Sister Song, because this is, I think, an important organization. There are a lot of organizations that complement each other, and I think Sister Song is one of those. So tell us about Sister Song.
Absolutely. Well, I'm very excited about this really organization and movement because I've written a bit about it. They're based out of Atlanta, Georgia. Their first national conference, I think prior to this national conference, they were forming the collective, but their first national conference was in 2003. Sister Song is an organization and movement that was established by a group of women of color. They refer to themselves as a women of color collective, who wanted to reframe the conversation surrounding issues of reproductive choice. At that time, primarily, it was the language, according to the pro-choice movement, of reproductive choice in terms of talking about the rights that women should certainly have to bodily self-determination as it relates to abortion, as well as other, you know, reproductive matters. And one of the things that Sister Song wanted to affirm but wanted to make an intervention on in terms of, at that time, the conversation surrounding reproductive choice. On the one hand, they did want to affirm that it is important for women in this nation to have access to choice in terms of their reproductive health. That's critically important in, you know, in terms of bodily autonomy and choice. But the intervention that they wanted to make is when you look at the history of Black women in particular, and you talk about Black women's reproductive health, one of the things that becomes clear, at least was clear for Sister Song, these women of color, is that Black women have not only had issues in terms of talking about the language of choice as it relates to having access to abortion, but Black women historically have also had issues on being able to decide to become mothers, right? Wow. I mean, historically, you know, from Black women being raped, not only during slavery, but, you know, during Reconstruction and Jim Crow law, women being raped, not having access to their own sense of bodily autonomy, to from the middle of the 20th century to now, Black mothers being castigated within the public media as, you know, lazy and indolent and welfare queens and pimping the system based off their reproductive capabilities, not needing to have children or raising criminal Black boys. The problem is that here Black mothers have been demonized, right? In terms of their right to motherhood. And not only that, Black women also, as I've talked about earlier, have been disenfranchised in terms of healthcare, in terms of childcare, in some pretty insidious ways that factor into a woman's ability to be a mother. And so what Sister Song wanted to do is they wanted to move beyond the singular focus on the language of rights in relationship to abortion that dominated the pro-choice movement at that time, right? And they wanted to open up that movement wider to issues of reproductive health among women of color, really by extension, all women, because I think white women in certain kinds of ways face some of these various issues,
certainly,
right? In terms of
certainly.
Reproductive, and the language of justice is really important. They opted for the language of reproductive justice rather than reproductive choice, although choice is a part of the language of justice.
Wow. Say a little bit more about that, because that is a very important distinction. It's not just reproductive rights, reproductive choice. It is reproductive justice. So talk about that, Carrie. That's absolutely important.
Absolutely. So in talking and them terming it reproductive justice, they were attempting to do two to three things. The first one is that the language of justice really signals at a systemic level profound injustices that impact a person's ability to actually choose. So in the language of choice alone, it doesn't necessarily get at the ways in which economic, political, and social policies and structures actually shape a woman's ability to choose or not choose, right?
Yes.
So here's one example. Legally, there can be, as Roe versus Wade, you know, allows women to make that choice.
Yes, and it's the 44th anniversary right now.
Right? Oh, that's right. That's right. So here's an example. Certainly, women have a right to choose, to reproductive choice. But what does it mean when there are particular black women, or say even young women, girls, who do not have access to certain economic or environmental resources that allow them to be able to live into that choice, right?
Right.
And so really what Sister Song is getting at is that it's not enough to simply talk through the language of rights and through the language of choice. We have to deal with those economic, social, and political conditions that impede women's choices. We have to talk about money, for example. That's really critical in talking about choice and rights, you know?
Yeah.
And so for them, so that was the first thing. We need to talk about the conditions that shape people's ability to actually choose and decide. Secondly, they wanted to use the language of justice because the language of justice communicates human rights. That's
course.
Really important, you know?
Yes.
So for them to speak about women's reproductive health in the language of reproductive justice, it gestures towards this nation that this is a human rights issue. And one thing about anything that is termed a human rights discourse is that it becomes eligible for intervention through a global community. I mean, this is why in certain countries around the world, they do not want to talk about women's equality as a human rights issue. Because if women's equality is framed around the world in certain countries as a human rights issue, then it is subject to intervention. That's really important because for Sister
Certainly.
Song, they want to say that women's reproductive health and quest for reproductive justice should literally be a conversation at the UN.
Absolutely. And speaking of that, I want you to continue on Sister Song, but I do want to interject this. Sister Joan Chittister, she talks about these individuals that are all pro-life and are against pro-choice, but then she questions, if you are truly pro-life, then that means you are pro-providing for the
Yes.
care of that new life. And there are no provisions. There is no major campaign out of a pro-life movement that provides pro-life access to health care and food and clothing and education
Yes.
for these children. So pro-life means life from birth to death. And
Yes.
that seems to be absent, according to Sister Joan. So it sounds to me like when you talk about Sister Song, they are encompassing all of these elements.
Yeah, and it's so important, Debo, that you have made this very important observation in your discussion of Sister Joan's, what she said. Because the third thing that sort of marks Sister Song's work is sort of the assertion that the categories of pro-life and pro-choice are simply inadequate.
Good.
They're inadequate altogether.
Yes.
They will not even talk about this issue within those categories, in terms of the polarization, I should say,
right.
of those categories. Because, as you said, there's a way in which Sister Song realizes that, when we're speaking of a woman who faces a choice, say, and it is to potentially terminate, that, and this is, you know, me right now talking as a theological thinker, as well as someone who preaches. And that is in my desire to see women have access to bodily self-determination, as well as access to choice in a myriad of ways. What people are not saying necessarily is that this act is a theological good. See, I think often the problem with quote unquote pro-life, the pro-life side, in addition to not supporting people when they come out of the womb, is they tend to think that they tend to frame pro-choice as being quote unquote pro-abortion, as if abortion is a sort of spiritual or theological good. And I want to question that. I think part of what, you know, many women recognize is that when women are faced with this decision, or even if it's the decision to have a child and mother, that this, you know, that they are situated within complex factors, factors oftentimes that are really the lesser of two evils, right? That they are indeed in a situation out of which there is profound pain. There's a profound complexity and ambiguity, and it's out of that profound sense of pain and angst, but desiring to do what is right in that moment for all parties involved, that women make these decisions.
Absolutely.
So it's not a matter of appraising any particular action as a quote unquote theological good, or as something that's good, which to me is such a misinterpretation and a caricaturing. Many of us who believe that women should have rights and choices to her body, that this is a profoundly painful choice, right?
I agree.
And so Sister Song is aware of that existential condition, of that profound spiritual moment in so many women's lives, and saying that part of that entire existential or spiritual discussion is bound up in this broader language of recognizing this is a human rights issue. Women are trying to ask, how can they be fully human in the choices that they make concerning the lives of themselves and others? And I also wanted to note this, Debo, that Sister Song has this amazing program called Trust Black Women.
I was going to ask you about that. Yes. Go, Carrie. Yes. I love this. Go ahead.
The entire campaign is really surrounding this idea, because most of the legislators that are creating policy surrounding this issue, they're men.
Yes.
And they're white men.
Oh, we just saw a picture of that a couple of weeks ago, right?
That's right. And they're quote-unquote Christian white men.
Oh, yes.
Of that, and conservative Christian white men. And so what does it mean when we're talking about reproductive justice and reproductive health? What does it mean when we are appealing to the legislative processes, the policymakers, to frame our discussions with this adamant assertion, we must learn how to trust Black women in particular, who are stigmatized? I've already talked about that, who are stigmatized and misrepresented. But what does it mean more broadly when we're coming into these various policy circles to demand and to proclaim that policymakers must learn how to trust women? Trust that they know their experiences.
Yes.
Trust that they are discerning the right thing to do. Trust that these women have a better sense of what's going on and what's needed than these men.
I was just getting ready to say, who better knows what is going on within the interior of a woman who is faced with these challenges than the woman herself? Men do not know. They truly do not know that side of an experience of these difficult matters that women have to deal with. And so this Trust Black Women partnership is most impressive. And now, is there a little bit more about the Trust Black Women? Because you, I wish we could say Trust Women period. But the Trust Black Women,
right,
are they working somehow with bringing in all of these different ethnic groups of all women? What about Black Lives Matter? Are they reaching into to all these different groups to raise awareness about exactly what they're trying to do in terms of legislation?
They are. And I think, again, so I know in Latina communities that is the case. I do know in certain Asian communities. So the one thing that I appreciate about Sister Song is they do refer to themselves as a woman of color collective.
Yes.
So that's a really important thing for me to know. They're doing the work. I think it's really, again, these organizations such as Sister Song being supported and being seen as organizations to collaborate with from broader women's organizations. You know, I mean, because honestly, you know, many of the women's organizations where so much of the funding, is, are organizations that are led by white women. So I think that's a really important point to know. And let me be clear, there are white women that are absolutely in solidarity with Sister Song. There's no doubt about that.
Great.
But I think it is just important for me to name that in terms of collaboration, there is still a long way to go in providing and all of us thinking critically about what it means for there to be bridge building and collaboration, particularly with white women's organizations in relationship to the movements and the work that women, people of color, but women of color in particular, are doing.
Well, Carrie, we could, again, go on, but I want to honor your time. I know you've got a full day ahead of you. I do hope that all of those who have the gift, the fortunate gift, to be able to hear this podcast, to hear your brilliance, your passion for women, for Black women, for all women, for the world. I think that they will be inspired, that they will be motivated, that there will be a new surge of coalition among women. And I am counting on we as women to stand up and to raise our hearts and to push forward with what needs to be done in order to preserve the presence and the value of all of women and their participation in the culture as a whole. So, Carrie, you are absolutely magnificent, sensational. It is a privilege to be able to visit with you. And I hope I get to see you real soon. You know, we talked about something earlier, and I'm hoping that we will see each other within the next couple of months.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Deborah, for the work that you do.
Well, thank you, Carrie, and we will talk again soon. Thanks a lot, Carrie.